Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book Spider podcast. This is a Book of the Week format podcast where when we say book, historically, we've mostly meant novels. But we do make occasional digressions into what you might call the philosophy of literature, larger questions about the nature of literature, the ways we evaluate it. And the episode we're doing today is probably the furthest from that standard format, aside from the fact that there is currently a giant spider in my bathtub that I have not yet had the heart to catch and release. But today we're going to be talking about our relationship to art more generally. And in fact, some of the examples on the topic today that I find most compelling are related to music and film, and in many cases, less connected to literature. So I'm Hans Berger. I'm here with my two co-hosts, Patrick Barney and Chris Malmberg. And a couple episodes we talked about a series of philosophical essays chosen by Patrick. One of the ones we chose was Noel Carroll's Moderate Moralism, which is about, into a very condensed way, was about reaching a moderate stance in relationship to evaluating a literary text for its moral qualities. Now, the interesting thing about that chapter, Moderate Moralism by Noel Carroll, the thing that I found interesting about it when I read it was that more than anything, it really seems to be pushing back against people who would evaluate an artwork in a moral vacuum, right? Who would respond strictly to the work's aesthetic qualities while ignoring its moral qualities. He calls that standpoint a radical autonomism. And that was interesting to read for two reasons, partly because I don't think anyone is advocating for radical autonomism in 2023, at least within the worlds of academia and mainstream cultural criticism. I'm not even sure that most people would say radical autonomism is possible in 2023. But also because in the last 10 years or so, it seems to me that we've actually become vastly more preoccupied with the morality of the lives of artists, as opposed to the moral content or effect of the text itself. And in fact, I think our moral understanding of a work of art now tends to almost always exist as a sort of a hybrid between the intrinsic moral quality of the work and our understanding of that artist's life, if that makes sense, right? The moral quality of the text is almost always evaluated partly in relationship to the morality of the artist's life. Now, we didn't actually get to discuss moderate moralism during the philosophy episode for time's sake, but it made me think of a book that I'd had on my shopping list for a while, which is Why It's Okay to Enjoy the Work of Immoral Artists by Mary Beth Willard. And that book is the focus of this episode. Now, Willard is an associate professor of philosophy at Weber State University, and this book uses philosophical techniques to demonstrate the thesis in the title that you are not ethically required to stop engaging aesthetically with the work of an artist who has lived a very immoral or even monstrous life. So this episode, we're going to be going through each of the prongs in Willard's argument. We're going to discuss how convincing those are, whether they change our relationship to the artwork of monstrous people. Incidentally, we're not going to talk about this book on the podcast, but if you're interested in this topic, another book I've read that pushes on some of these questions in a different way is Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma by Claire Dieterer, which approaches pretty much the same question, but where Willard's book is tightly focused, argumentative, Dieterer's is more like a series of questions with no answers, and also much more emotional. It makes a very interesting companion to this work. Now, I thought it would be interesting to talk about this theme, right? The question of the question of whether or not we need to give up the work of immoral artists. I thought it would be interesting to talk about this in relationship to a concrete example. And so I tried to think of an immoral artist whose work I still find worth engaging with. Now, I've been, for the most part, pretty lucky in terms of the various kinds of cultural cataclysms around Me Too. For the most part, I haven't really had anybody that I'm that fond of be affected by the whole thing. But one example that did come to mind is the musician Marilyn Manson, who became quite successful in the mid-1990s, playing a very theatrical and conceptual form of industrial metal, made everybody's mom very upset with it before fading from public view around 2000 or so, becoming mainly of interest to a core audience of residual fans, before coming back into public view when he was accused of physical and sexual abuse by several former romantic partners in 2021. And to be clear, you know, I don't think Manson is a great musician according to my current standards and tastes. Even before 2021, I could have thought of, you know, literally 100 artists that I like much, much more, if not more than that. But I do think his work has many qualities which make it intriguing to revisit. You know, between the second half of my sophomore year and the second half of the first half of my junior year in high school, there probably wasn't any other artist that I listened to more or thought about more or talked about more. I was a big fan of progressive rock from a very young age. And when I got into high school and I was trying to connect with the music that was popular then and use music as kind of a way to bridge relationships with my peers and find commonality with people, you know, this was an artist that a lot of my peers liked or would respect me for liking, who was doing something that had, you know, the kind of conceptual depth and unity of something like The Wall by Pink Floyd or the kind of theatricality of old Genesis, right? It felt like a bridge between popular hard rock of the 90s and certain aesthetics of progressive rock, which is probably not something that many people would think of, but that was, you know, a way that music had value for me as a teenager. Now, so I one thing that I may or may not kind of come back to, Patrick, I know that you were until a few years ago a fan of his work as well, and so I thought it would be interesting to have a concrete example of, you know, an immoral artist, a bad person whose work we have some kind of relationship to, so that we kind of have a concrete touchstone for how these theories kind of play into our actual cultural intake. And a couple caveats, you know, I want to make it clear that the type of abuse Manson's been accused of is about as bad a thing as any individual can do to another. The goal here is not to minimize or excuse that, right? Willard's program very explicitly involves acknowledging the harms done by monstrous individuals. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later. And the second thing, just to be clear, and this is something that a couple people have been confused by when I discussed this book with them before the podcast. You know, Willard's not saying that you're required to continue engaging with the work of immoral artists, right? If the stain associated with a person's deeds makes that work impossible for you to appreciate, then that's totally fine, right? Aesthetic responses are very individual, very contingent on a lot of different factors, many of which are much smaller than that, but, you know, much smaller than that type of monstrousness, but still quite legitimate. So, you know, the idea of the book is not that you are wrong for giving that work up if it no longer interests or pleases you. The idea of the work is that if you are aesthetically able to continue enjoying, say, a Roman Polanski film, right, and making that enjoyment part of a larger aesthetic project, then you shouldn't feel guilty for doing that, and, you know, you shouldn't be subject to social sanction for doing that as long as you are not advertising that continued appreciation in a way which seems antisocial, right? So, you know, the idea here is not that one should feel wrong for giving up the work of immoral artists, but that one should have latitude within one's conscience to not do so. All right. So with all that prelude, I'm going to just kind of, the Willard's book has 6 chapters. And so I'm kind of going to go through each of the chapters one by one and talk in a little bit of depth about how she builds the argument on those chapters. And we can, as we go, we can see whether or not those, the topics that she brings up, you know, are convincing. So the first idea that Willard introduces is non-fungibility, right? Which basically just means artworks are not interchangeable. If you remove from your life the experience of one artwork, you can't readily swap in another, even if the other one is quite similar, right? If you say, well, I'm no longer going to watch Rosemary's Baby, but it's okay because, you know, I still have other 70s horror movies. Well, there are particular qualities to Rosemary's Baby that would be that make it unique and irreplaceable, right? To use our example, someone might say, you know, well, you can ditch Manson and still have Nine Inch Nails and Skinny Puppies, so what's the big deal, right? But the concept of non-fungibility, as Willard advocates, it would say that we just need to recognize that our relationship to a distinct artwork, the experience of a distinct artwork, is not something that can be easily replaced by any other work, however surface level similar it might seem. Do you guys agree with that? Do you think that that non-fungibility has the power that she attributes to it?
My take is that I understand what you're saying about fungibility. That doesn't seem super mysterious to me. My take is that I agree that artworks are non-fungible. You know, like, Corrupted is my favorite doom metal band of all time. I also like the stoner doom metal band Sleep, but they're, you know, I would not say that if Corrupted were if for some reason, you know, the members of Corrupted turned out to be horrible people, you know, it wouldn't, you know, Sleep would not replace them. So I do agree with her on that, but I don't think that non-fungibility is a great argument. Just because, like, we can imagine a scenario where, you know, if it were wrong to listen to the work of an immoral artist for some other reason, you know, like, let's say listening to the work of an immoral artist caused a great harm. Let's, you know, it doesn't, but let's just say it does for the sake of what I'm saying. If that were the case, then non-fungibility would just not be a good argument at all. You know, like, you not being able to listen to Corrupted, but still being able to listen to Sleep, and that involving an aesthetic deficit, certainly wouldn't, it wouldn't make, it acceptable to listen to if listening to Corrupted or supporting the band Corrupted caused great harm, then certainly the non-fungibility between Corrupted and Sleep would not make it okay to listen to Corrupted, is all I'm saying.
Sure, that makes sense. So basically, if I'm kind of extrapolating what you're saying to the rest of the argument, if it does not cause harm to listen to an immoral artist, then it doesn't really matter about non-fungibility or not, right? Because it's a non-harmful activity either way. If it did actually cause great harm, then non-fungibility would not really be an adequate justification. So either the rest of the argument makes the concept of non-fungibility irrelevant, or the rest of the argument, if it fails, still makes non-fungibility irrelevant. It's not really relevant because either if no harm is caused, then fungibility shouldn't matter, or if great harm is caused, then fungibility is too small to overcome that.
Yeah, that's what I would say on the topic of fungibility.
That seems fair. Yeah, that seems entirely reasonable.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, Patrick. And I think fungibility is a specific angle that may be valuable for addressing, basically, fungibility is different. An artwork being fungible is different from an artwork being derivative, right? So, like, we can say that an artwork being very much like an immoral artist's work being very much like the work of some saintly other artist, and the two feeling somewhat derivative of one another. actually does not. It's the experience of the artwork that is non-fungible. The relationship, the kind of many factors that go into someone's relationship to a piece of work. Like if Hans had discovered Marilyn Manson later in life, then he might have a different relationship to that artwork. But he experienced it at a specific time in his life where that experience of that artwork, his aesthetic experience of Marilyn Manson, is non-fungible for what it is and in his past and in his development. So I think that that's at least a useful thing to take from Willard, but I think you're right, Patrick. I think, and I didn't put my finger on it when I was reading it, but it felt like she was trying to measure, to establish the a kind of a measure of the relative impact of dismissing an artist's work from your life without really actually developing a mechanism for measuring the relative pain that causes you against the relative pain that it might cause others. And you're saying that there really isn't a cause of pain for others. She kind of works her way to that. Like if you were to sort of listen to Marilyn Manson and post to Twitter, now X, every day about how like amazing he is, and then maybe that's a kind of a broadcasting of your aesthetic experience that might actually do harm. But simply listening to Marilyn Manson, it's not, that doesn't actually have any material collateral damage in the real world. You're absolutely right, Patrick.
And I think that just to kind of get back to the purpose of non-fungibility in the argument, I suppose what she's trying to do there, among other things, is lay down some understanding of, or make an argument for the importance and the merit of individual artworks in a person's life.
Right.
And regardless of whether or not the concept of non-fungibility is necessary to build the larger argument, I suppose part of the idea of having it there is just to kind of connect us maybe even more in an emotional way with kind of an understanding of why we have attachment to particular things, right? I mean, she talks about, I feel like we should invoke this concept. She talks about the idea of an aesthetic project, right? Which is, as I understood it, a somewhat loosely defined term that, as she uses it, can involve both the appreciation of or the creation of a work of art, right? So like running a Harry Potter fan site is an aesthetic project. Baking your own bread is an aesthetic project, right? This podcast would be an aesthetic project. The music that I make on my own is an aesthetic project, right? As I'm understanding the terms that she uses. And that the book is very, justifiably, because I agree with this standpoint, right? The book is very generous toward the idea of the aesthetic project in one's life. And non-fungibility is something that ties to that. I just want to bring that term in because that is something that she refers back to a lot. I suppose that it's an interesting question because one of the things that she seems to be, one thing that she seems to be coming back to is partly the idea that, I don't know maybe if that art should be something we consume as part of a larger project, right? But it doesn't seem to make much allowance for just putting, if I put an album on as background music while I do the dishes, is that an aesthetic project? I suppose it is, right? But I mean, she's much more interested in kind of like this sort of large scale, deeply involved relationship to art sort of thing, right? I might have not said that particularly well, but it kind of raises the question of like what is the aesthetic project that you or I, Patrick, would want to get from Marilyn Manson? I mean, I guess for me, it's like anything that I've been very into at some point in my life, it's interesting for me to come back to it periodically as I change, as I mature, as I learn more about music, as I learn more about production, as I spend more time trying to write music and other media. to come back to it once a year or so and just kind of say, like, how has this work changed for me? How has my relationship changed to it? What am I hearing here that I didn't before? And what is there here that I used to find appealing that I no longer do, right? And I suppose that kind of aesthetic project actually would be maybe more practicable if you recognize, like, the monstrousness of the artist does not, in fact, rule out that kind of aesthetic project, because it, the way that you respond to that or assimilate that is, in fact, a way of understanding how your relationship to art has changed, as you've changed, as your context has changed, right? It's, and that might make it easier for me. I mean, usually when I come back to that music, it's always been in a more clinical way, right? It's always been in a more analytical way. It's always been more as a way of kind of saying, like, how do I remember my 15-year-old self, and how am I different and similar to that person now? And I suppose there's a way in which it's easier to accommodate that monstrousness of the artist than if you're just listening to it because you want to connect with it in the way you would connect to any other music that you like, if that makes sense. So the next topic that Willard introduces, or not really a topic, but the next part of her argument, and maybe the first one that is a little bit more directly argumentative, is the idea of the boycott, right? The question of the worth of a boycott. So Willard says, you know, if works are non-fungible, then there truly is a sacrifice involved in giving up a particular work of art. There is a sacrifice involved in, a meaningful sacrifice that shouldn't be undertaken lightly in giving up a particular work. And she considers the act of boycotting an artist's work. She asserts that most of the time boycotts are not effective, which means that it's functionally purposeless to try to punish an artist by giving up their work. And I think this might actually be, you know, when I've talked to people about the, when I've talked to people about this book, I think this is the chapter that gets the most pushback, right? Because we're not used to the idea. Socially, I think almost nobody on the left or right wants to admit that boycotts are not effective, or maybe would just disagree with the idea that boycotts are not effective, right? Like, we're very, very sold as a culture on our, the idea of our power as a consumer, right? And the few boycotts that are in fact effective tend to get a great deal of attention. So it's a little bit jarring to just be told, actually, you know, most of the time when we're told that we need to give up a particular artist for a moral reason, like, most people don't do that, and that idea in the culture actually does not produce change in a way that meaningfully punishes the artist. So how did you guys react to that chapter? Do you agree with her? Do you think that it's fair to say that most boycotts are not effective?
To me, it wasn't, I mean, I think that her reasoning that boycotts are not effective is probably correct. And I also, I thought that was interesting that you pointed out that people push back on that, because, yeah, like, my gut reaction is like, was like, this isn't right. You know, like, probably because I have internalized the consumer boycott bullshit that, you know, our society feeds into us, that we vote with our dollar, which is garbage. But
sorry to interrupt. Why is that garbage? Because it's capitalist, or?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that voting with your dollar is garbage because, like, how we really need to, I don't, like, quote unquote vote, or how we need to get our voices heard is through, you know, direct action. You know, so this is just me being, you know, an anarchist who thinks that, you know, money shouldn't mediate our, you know, the democratic processes of our society, right? Yeah, so it, but on further reflection, I don't think this argument is extremely successful, and it's not because she's right. She's right that boycotts don't really work, but she also approaches this argument from only one moral position, and that's act utilitarianism. She says that basically, boycotting an artist's work doesn't cause any benefit. So there's no, and since non-fungibility means that there is some sacrifice to giving up the work of an immoral artist that you really enjoy, because of that, there's no utility in giving it up. Like, it causes no benefit to other people and causes disutility to you. However, that's only an act utilitarian standpoint. I think that a virtue ethicist and a rule utilitarian might have grounds to argue that this argument doesn't work. One, the virtue ethicist is going to say something like, well, morality is about cultivating certain virtues, and it is not virtuous to support the work of someone who is immoral, so we shouldn't do it because it's not virtuous. Does that make sense? Okay, so that would be the virtue ethicist's argument against this. The rule utilitarian's argument might be something like, well, we're focusing on individual acts too much. Let's think about what should the rule about this be? Let's think of the best rule, the rule that's going to cause the most utility. Now, I'm not sure what that rule would be, but I can't imagine some rule consequentialist or rule utilitarian saying that maybe the rule would be to give this up, because we can expect, if we create a rule that we don't support the work of immoral artists and everybody follows it, then the immoral artists don't succeed in the realm of aesthetics, which might be a good thing, you know, depending on whether if that makes sense.
Well, that addresses one of the problems that she lays out specifically, which is that individual action undertaken under the guise or the sort of illusion of collective action rarely actually produces any material difference in the world. And if you boycott Ryan Adams and, you know, you and 10% of his fans boycott him, he still has 90% of his fans listening to him, and then that collective action doesn't work anymore. So a rule ethicist, you would say, would basically resolve that. Not necessarily, like, in theory, a rule ethicist would propose a theoretical solution to that would solve for that collective action, individual action problem.
Like, the rule ethicist is going to say, whether or not the boycott succeeds, if the correct rule is to boycott, you should do it, whether or not anybody else does it or not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Because the rule ethicist thinks that the proper thing to do is to follow the rule that will maximize utility. And so it's a little different, but...
No, I think it makes sense. This is a little bit separate, a little bit of a separate dimension of a criticism, and I don't know where in philosophy what ethical lens this would fall on, but I really felt that she glanced over legacy as something to impact in the art. Basically, she mentions it very briefly, but I think what she's doing is she's touching upon legacy and then kind of retreating very quickly to utility by saying that, like, well, affecting Michael Jackson's legacy doesn't have any impact on Michael Jackson because Michael Jackson is dead. And I actually think that that's an interesting take. I think that that's an interesting sort of way of forcing the frame of the conversation, because I think that most artists actually really give a massive shit about their legacy. And so I think that yes, you can say that Michael Jackson is not like he's not experiencing the you know, the impact on his legacy, but it still matters. And I don't know how to frame that necessarily, but it felt like kind of, it felt to me like that was a hard thing for her argument to circumscribe. And so she kind of avoided it.
Yeah. I mean, in the particular, this is a specific thing and not a kind of general thing, but like in the particular instance of Michael Jackson, I mean, in the period after the Leaving Neverland documentary came out, if I remember correctly, I think his estate came out quite intensely against the victims who spoke in the documentary, right? So if you're if you think of believing victims as being an important value, or if you think of supporting victims as being an important value, which is touched on in a later chapter, the people who are benefiting from the purchase of Michael Jackson music are in fact working against the belief and support of victims, right? So the fact that Michael Jackson is himself dead doesn't matter so much if his estate, which is financially benefiting from the purchase of his music, is working against justice, right? So I think the example, just in the at the most pragmatic level, I think the example doesn't hold up. Aside from the fact that, you know, if boycotts don't work, then that, you know, makes it irrelevant to boycott either way, right? But like the fact that he's dead doesn't actually have any relevance, just in a very kind of narrow way, right, for that reason.
Like it could still, the fact that some people are still benefiting from the work of a pedophile.
Well, people, not just the fact that somebody's benefiting, but, you know, people are benefiting who are working against reconciliation with the victims, right? I mean, it'd be one thing if, you know, his kids were benefiting. Okay, that's fine, right? That's good, but... And I mean, obviously, you know, I'm somewhat simplifying a complex case, but...
And Patrick, but just before, because like it seemed like you were saying that... that you didn't buy the, like, if there isn't a utility, like a, if there isn't a utility to boycotting, that still does, you're not convinced by that argument.
No, I'm not exactly sure what I think. Like I, you know, I feel like I'm in, like I disagree with Willard in a lot of specific ways. But overall, I'm not sure that I come to a different conclusion. Like I'm not sure whether it's if we're ethically required to give up the work of an immoral artist. But so just looking at it from as many perspectives as possible, it is possible for boycotts to fail, but some ethical arguments might still suggest that we should boycott. You know, those being, you know, the virtue ethicist who says that it's not virtuous to enjoy the work of someone who's immoral, so we should try to build up our own virtue and give it up, which would mean that we are ethically required to give it up, or the rule utilitarian position, which is a little vaguer. We would have to know for certain what the rule about this should be. So I don't know, but yeah.
Does it, two things that seem to me to complicate this, right? And I don't know, I don't have a good answer for how to reconcile these observations. But first of all, in most cases, it's generally possible to experience a work of art without financially benefiting the artist, right? Like to the particular example of Marilyn Manson, I mean, I have a giant wall of CDs in my living room, and three of those are the best Marilyn Manson albums, right? So I can listen to his music anytime I
which
want to,
are?
Not Antichrist Superstar, Mechanical Animals, and Hollywood, of course. I've got Portrait and Smells Like Children there too, but those are not at the same time.
I would definitely agree that Antichrist Superstar and Hollywood are in the two of the three best. I don't know about Mechanical Animals, but go on.
Sure. And mechanical animals, I mean, if I came to that as an adult, I might feel differently about it, right? There's a certain amount of, like, teen angst that I wrapped up in that album that, anyway.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry to derail.
But, I mean, the point is just that, no. I mean, it's often entirely possible to experience the work of an immoral artist without benefiting that person financially. You can, if you want to watch Chinatown and not give Roman Polanski any money, you know, you can find a used DVD on eBay or probably get it from the library, right? Now, I suppose you could argue that in some of those cases, maybe you're creating a chain of effects that ultimately might still benefit the artist, right? So, like, I've never liked the music of R. Kelly, but if I wanted to listen to R. Kelly, I could buy a used R. Kelly album off eBay and, you know, not benefit R. Kelly because no royalties would come from that used purchase. But presumably, if everybody thought that way, then all the used R. Kelly albums would be off eBay and, you know, you would lose that option. So to some extent, I mean, that out is only offered if not everybody takes it, right? But, I mean, it's still worth noting, I think, in terms of the larger argument, that it is in many cases possible to experience the work of the immoral artist without financially benefiting that person. Aside from the fact that, you know, most of the financial benefit that you do provide is so tiny as to be almost meaningless. If you're using Spotify.
Yeah, like even listening to Spotify, like even if I wanted to listen to Manson on Spotify, like I'd be, each time I listened, it would be fractions upon fractions upon fractions of a cent, you know, so.
The other thing too, in some cases, I think that there's an unfortunate trade-off that's created for all the other people who are involved in that artwork, right? So like, again, to the Polanski example, like how many people were involved in the production of Rosemary's Baby or Chinatown, right? Like hundreds, if not thousands. And it's very unfortunate, I think, to obviously, you know, a small percentage of those people would receive financial residuals if you were to, you know, watch that movie. But people other than Polanski who are blameless still have a financial stake, right? The screenwriter for Rosemary's Baby still has a financial stake in people continuing to watch Rosemary's Baby. And from a legacy standpoint, you know, if you're Mia Farrow, right, like, that's like a career-defining performance for her. So if the awfulness of Polanski's behavior removes that film from the canon, then you are incidentally destroying the legacy of a woman who has done nothing wrong. This obviously applies much more to some examples than others, right? I mean, if we're talking about a painter or a novelist or somebody like that, then I don't think that you can feel pretty blameless in that regard, right? But for something like a film or even an album where there's kind of this large network of people around it, most of whom are, you know, not guilty of the same crimes, I don't have a great answer for how that fits into the larger calculation, but it seems to be, I don't even remember hearing Willard talk about it that much, and that actually seems very, very important to me, right? Particularly in the film example, where so many other people's legacies and careers are also affected by your response to a film. So, Chapter 3 discusses epistemic justice, right? Which can be summarized in a very brief and simplified way as the imperative to believe victims and to remedy historical patterns of not believing victims or not recognizing the presence of victimization. And Willard really takes pains to emphasize the importance of that project, right? The importance of remedying historical patterns of not believing victims, the importance of changing the way that we respond to accusations in ways which emphasize believing victims, while maintaining that it's not inconsistent with that project to continue to engage with the works of artists who victimize. And some of that comes down to the kind of the ability to distinguish between our emotional response to the art and the emotional response to the individual behind it, which she discusses at greater length in Chapter 4. But did you guys find the argument in Chapter 3 on epistemic justice convincing?
I don't know. Like the it strikes me, listening to Patrick talk about virtue ethicism, that this actually introduces a different angle on, in a purely sort of pragmatic, like, are people impacted sense, in a way that, can be measured. You can certainly believe and outwardly support, the accusers of Marilyn Manson while, listening to Hollywood. But that also feels like it could be problematic. I think that, like, within the frame that she draws, like, she's entirely right. Like, I don't think that there's a problem with her argument. I just think that, again, like, the way that she frames this around, I think there's a way that all of this stacks up that we're going to get to chapter 6, and we're going to talk a little bit about, like, the function of the, artwork itself, or, the function of the aesthetic project itself as, a factor in this, that, maybe the function of the aesthetic project is powerful enough to actually compete with the power of the immoral artist's, sort of zone of effect on all of this. But I don't know that I, without talking about sort of the relative merits of that artwork, it's hard for me to sort of justify. It feels like, Patrick's virtue ethicist would say it's wrong to outwardly support someone in their accusations against an immoral artist and then enjoy that immoral artist's work.
Yeah, like that, it strikes you a little bit of hypocrisy, right? To be like, oh yeah, Evan Rachel Wood, I totally support you. I believe that Manson it was awful to you. And then I go home and I'm like, listening to Crypt Orchid, like it's fucking great.
I think that might be, this is why I say, like, the relative value of the aesthetic project, because, like, if the relative value of the aesthetic of enjoying Marilyn Manson is, like Hans said, like there's, a space that Marilyn Manson's artwork occupies in his past that, is non-fungible, and it's actually, like, kind of important to him to be able to revisit that. And I actually think that is entirely valid, and that the thing, and this is, I think, kind of, I think it's Willard's failure to, at least in my reading of the book, to kind of connect open the doors to evaluating, like, really, like, I don't know that she doesn't do this, but I just can't think of the part in the book where she does. Yes, there is relative value of the aesthetic experience, and yes, there is pain involved in, there is the, what is it? The epistemic justice, the obligation to believe and support those victims. And there's some kind of evaluatory process of, like, what is the role of this aesthetic experience in my life? Like, and it's, Marilyn Manson may be a particularly hard one measure there, but I don't think that it's, off the rails to suggest that this is actually like a keystone in you know, in some people's development, perfectly ethically good human beings' development. And giving that up is a kind of a is a kind of a painful thing. And drawing a line down the middle where you don't give the thing up, but you still support the victims is ethically fine. I just don't know. I feel like there are dots marked that are not connected in Willard's work on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's something about, and I'm to some extent just repeating something that you said earlier here, but like, it seems entirely logical to me to say that you can epistemically believe and support victims and still listen to that work without logically betraying that, right? Or appreciate the film or whatever, right? And I think to some extent the more, and maybe this is just using my own kind of habits here to shield myself, right? But like, I suppose the more clinical that you are about that, the more cover you have for that, right? If you're watching Chinatown and you're, we all went to grad school together. And Chris, were you in the screenwriting class that I took in grad school?
Yes.
We covered Chinatown in the screenwriting class, right? So, you know, if you're watching Chinatown with a very direct eye toward thinking about how it's laid out as a screenplay, that doesn't at all seem to me to be irreconcilable with believing that Polanski did what he did to that girl, right? The point I'm just making, I think, is that the more targeted and specific you are in your appreciation, the easier it is, I think, to reconcile those intuitively, right? I mean, Antichrist Superstar is produced in a very fascinating way. There are all kinds of really intriguing sonic choices, most of which I assume came from Trent Reznor and David Ogilvy, right? If I'm listening to Cryptorchid and I'm thinking, oh, that weird percussion loop at the beginning is really fascinating, the Mellotron that they use in the coda and the vocoder, those are such interesting choices. Like, now that I've spent more time producing music, I have a better sense of how clever a choice that was in 1996. Again, probably on, you know, the part of either Trent Reznor or David Ogilvy. Obviously, you know, the thinking that Evan Rachel Wood is entirely correct and that Manson is a monstrous human being, those are not at all irreconcilable, right? I suppose the point is just that the more thoughtful and detailed we are with what aspects of the work we're approaching, the easier it is to kind of intuitively reconcile those things to where we don't feel hypocritical.
Yeah, and I think Chinatown's an interesting example because that movie concerns the sexual assault of a, you know, of a young woman who happens to be the kind of the antagonist's daughter. And then kind of the, you know, this is the thing where like the relative power and merit of the artwork plays into this. And then especially when you consider maybe the, you know, the place that artwork occupies in a particular viewer's, you know, like sense of identity, their sense of like, you know, like basically like, you know, Polanski being a sexual predator and the movie really drawing a monstrous picture of a sexual predator is a very, you know, it's a fascinating kind of like battle, I think, where, you know, maybe that's at least an easier one for me to kind of like draw an example around where someone might, you know, value what Chinatown does in that arena while condemning Polanski for his crimes.
So some of what we've talked about here has to do with what Willard approaches in chapter 4, right? Which is the extent to which, to a greater or lesser amount, we can separate the art from the artist, meaning there are some works whose identity and persona is so tied to that of the creator that it's impossible to engage with it without feeling the distaste that you feel for that, for the individual behind it, right? And that kind of creates an arbitrary distinction, but still a significant one, between someone like Roman Polanski, who we've talked about a lot, who's quite absent from his work as an individual, just to the extent that, like, you don't have any sense of the kind of character of Roman Polanski watching Chinatown, right? As opposed to maybe kind of the worst example in the other direction being Bill Cosby, who is entirely inextricable from his work. Even though theoretically Cliff Huxtable is a character being portrayed by an actor, as Willard notes in the book, great work has been done to entirely conflate the personae of Cliff Huxtable and Bill Cosby, right? So, and I don't necessarily know that I mean, I think the ideas that she has there, right, the chapter essentially, if I can summarize it, basically comes down to emphasizing that our relative response to a Polanski film versus a Cosby, an episode of The Cosby Show, among other things, that should be an opportunity to recognize and correct the cognitive distortions which lead us to be too worshipful of artists as individuals, right? To recognize and correct the ways in which our fondness for the work conflates itself with our fondness for the artists. To some extent, it's subjective and arbitrary that a Polanski film should be more approachable than an episode of The Cosby Show, but it's inevitably still a response that we have because of cognitively distorting responses that we have where, you know, as Willard notes, like, an actor who plays creepy people will tend to regard as creepy, for instance, right? I don't even know if I have a clear yes or no question around chapter four. I mean, I think her basic point that, if I'm understanding it correctly, her basic point in chapter four is that we are, for various reasons, we are in fact, as a result of how our brains organically function, probably too prone to conflating fondness or repulsion for character and actor or artist and art, and that those are good things to try to be measured about, and in particular to just in general in daily life, totally aside from individual revelations of a particular person being monstrous, to just generally try to, as much as possible, separate those responses in day-to-day habit, right? And I mean, that all seems reasonable to me, and I'd agree with it. I don't know if it's a program that most people will undertake, but it does seem reasonable to me. Did you guys have any thoughts about chapter four?
Well, it just reminds me that I need to stop thinking of Arnold Schwarzenegger as a badass because he so often plays a badass, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Or yeah. Liam Neeson, I need to stop thinking of him as like a former spy who can hunt down his daughter's kidnappers.
I've heard Arnold Schwarzenegger's actually a very poor fighter. Like, he's kind of well known for, like, yeah, he's really well known for, like, not knowing how to use his bulk, and actually, like, most people could kick his ass.
Well, you know, he was a bodybuilder. He was never a fighter, so. But, like, I mean, I made a joke about this, but I do think it's interesting, like, I'm going to admit that when I was younger, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger was a big part of my life. You know, when I was a kid, his movies were very important to me.
Well, you do have that tattoo of him on your chest.
And under my balls.
That's right.
Yeah. But like, if you just because I was a huge fan, and, like, you know, revisiting him as an adult, like, revisiting his movies and revisiting, like, interviews with him, like, he clearly thinks of himself as a badass, like, you know, hold, you know, when you spend years in front of the camera holding guns and throwing grenades and shit, you think of yourself as a badass. So like it's interesting to me that that cognitive distortion we're talking about can happen to the artist, him or herself too. Like they become too wrapped up in the characters they play.
You know, you mentioned, Patrick, the band Neurosis. The guitarist and singer Scott Kelly has admitted to having been abusive to his family for a long period of time. And I didn't find that particularly difficult to reconcile, right? Like, I didn't find that shocking in the way that you did. And I was trying to figure out why that was. It was surprising, but it wasn't, I didn't find it difficult to, like, I can imagine still listening to Neurosis, just, you know, at a, subjectively, I wouldn't find it intolerable to still listen
to
Neurosis.
Yeah, I wouldn't find it intolerable. I mean, I still love Neurosis. Well, I mean, some of their albums are not that great, I don't think, but, like, when they're...
But the great ones are still great.
Yeah, the great ones are still great. And part of that is, like, the band has a collective ethos that isn't just Scott Kelly. So I don't make the same connection with Scott Kelly. Like, I don't inevitably, like, wrap those two up the way that, like, you would Bill Cosby with Cliff Huxtable. However, like one of the things that might be different in between our situations is that I actually met him and like had a like conversation with him at one of his solo shows where there were only like 40 people in attendance, and like he manned his own merch booth. And you know, so I went up to the merch booth and bought a shirt and was just talking to him, and like, you know, he just seemed like a normal, actually more than just a normal dude, like the way that he engaged with fans, like being willing to ask, to answer questions about like when the new Neurosis album was coming out, and things like that. Like he seemed like a very personable individual. So when you meet someone in a scenario where they seem so personable and amiable, it is a shock when you hear, oh, he's been mentally and physically abusing his family for years and years and years. That's fucked up.
I guess I should make sure that we bring in chapter 6, right? Which basically asserts that an aesthetic project can advance a moral understanding in ways which transcend the acts of the artist. Willard's example being, you know, people who've spent many years drawing messages of tolerance and compassion out of the Harry Potter novels while rejecting J.K. Rowling's views about trans people. Did you find that argument compelling, that the moral benefit of properly engaging with the work can outweigh the badness of the artist?
Yeah, I'm pretty convinced by this. I feel like you know, it occurred to me, actually, not while I was reading the book, but just while I was reading your questions, that, you know, David Lynch, there's a director's name that directors use when they want to sort of disavow work, and I don't remember what it is. David Lynch did it for Dune. Alan Smithy, certain cuts of Dune. I think Schroeder did it, or someone else did it. I just heard about recently. You know, there could be a name that we ascribe to as authorship to works of art where we want to just sort of allow the art to disengage itself from the artist because the artist is problematic and the art is worth saving, you know, like almost like a reverse Alan Smithy for J.K. Rowling and her books, because you know, I've never read them, but it does seem like they do, they are invested in you know, acceptance, pluralism, acceptance, and it's interesting that I think that a work of art that is doing that work is worth saving for itself, I guess is the way to say it.
And I agree with that.
Yeah, no, I do agree with that. And I think this is going to sound kind of simplistic, but, you know, life is hard and people need pleasure and distraction. You know, life is hard and people need thriller.
Thriller is pretty good. It's pretty great.
I feel nothing about Thriller.
Yeah, I can actually live without Thriller too. I'm being a...
I don't need Thriller, but it's hard not to kind of like be, we have a tradition here in Portland. This is the thing about works of art, is that they base the traditions of a work of art can actually like carry it away from the identity of the artist to the extent that it no longer even really like connects with them. But like there's a kind of a courtyard in downtown Portland where every Halloween there's a flash dance or whatever, like when a huge massive crowd gets together and dances, and they do Thriller every year, and it's kind of a little beloved tradition. You know, they do this, you know, they all dress up like zombies and stuff, and they dance, and the whole town rocks out to, you know, that song for a few minutes. And you know, there's definitely vestiges of, you know, Michael Jackson in that, but it's been going on for years since, you know, he's died, and it seems to have developed a life of its own, which I think further distinguishes it from the immoral artist.
All right. Well, that feels like a pretty organic stop. I'm afraid we may have to give moderate moralism the shaft once again.
Sorry. I accept.
Do you have any... Patrick, I'm just curious. I feel like you have a... And maybe I'm totally mischaracterizing here. I think that you have a... My sense is that you have somewhat of a disconnect between how you think about this emotionally and how you think about this rationally. That some part of you recognizes that rationally... You could put on Antichrist Superstar and think, cool production, damn, good guitar sound. Wow, he's an asshole, but listen to that particular vocal technique. That you could have that response to it and not be behaving in a way that was unethical, certainly not in a way that would have any measurable effect on Evan Rachel Wood or anyone else that he had hurt. But that you have emotionally... that's impossible for you to do. Am I characterizing that roughly correctly?
Yeah, I would say... Not just roughly, I would say exactly correctly. Like, rationally, I think that, as I said earlier, I think that, while I think I quibble with a lot of Willard's arguments, rationally, I accept that there is no ethical requirement to give up an immoral artist. Emotionally, certain artists, there's probably nothing I can do about it. Like, with Manson... Like, I'm just too disgusted by him. Even though, like, you know, Kinderfeld is a fucking awesome track on Antichrist Superstar. Or, you know, even though I still really dig The Great Southern Trendkill by Pantera, like, I can't deal with the fact that Maybe Phil Anselmo is not actually a white supremacist. Maybe he's just a giant moron. You still can't.
I would lean much more toward giant moron myself.
Yeah. Like, I still can't deal with the fact that he gave a fucking white power salute at a concert. Like, I can't. No. Like, dude, I'm not doing that.
I think in terms of, you know, we talked a little bit about the... ethical value that we get from approaching a particular work. And I've been trying to think, The example, of course, being, you know, people get an ethical value out of Harry Potter, even if J.K. Rowling has certain views that they disagree with. I'm trying to think what the ethical value has been for me of approaching Manson's music. I think that there's a way that, as a teenager, I was very seduced by the idea of someone who was intelligent and attractive and charismatic in a very unconventional way, right? And I think the dangerousness of his persona was a key part of that. It was a key part of the kind of, it was a key part of the charisma. And I think for the dangerousness to feel authentic, he actually kind of had to be a bad guy, right? And that's one thing that really separates him from almost everyone else who's ever played in heavy music. I mean, it's characteristic of almost all dark, heavy music in whatever genre, right? Industrial or death metal or black metal or whatever. Like, there's always there's a very strong tradition of the nastiest, darkest, meanest stuff being made by cuddly people.
Like, the
obviously, there are big exceptions, right? But, like, you know, Cannibal Corpse does raped, strangled, fucked with a knife. And then, like, you know, George Fisher is like this big cuddly guy who'll give you a hug and take you shopping for action figures at Toys R Us.
Yeah, I was actually going to use Cannibal Corpse as a as an example, because I think the lead singer also gives away, like, toy bears that he wins in those vending machine things to kids with cancer or something, you know?
Yeah.
So,
and I think that the, you know, as a teenager, I think that, like, the authenticity of the darkness was really what set that music apart, even from something like Nine Inch Nails, right?
Right.
Or Skinny Puppy. And there's a way in which it was very short-sighted of me to allow myself to be as seduced by that as I was. And I suppose that there's some, probably a significant value in understanding that now as an older, more mature person, and revisiting the music as part of gaining that understanding. And that's a hard understanding. That's an unpleasant thing to think about oneself and recognize in oneself. Is it in exchange for assimilating that unpleasant, hard understanding, is it perhaps a reasonable trade-off that I get to then enjoy that weird, gross train sound in Kinderfeld?
Right.
I don't know.
Right. I don't know either.
All right. Yeah, no. And nobody knows, right? I think anybody who actually knows is bluffing or oversimplifying the question.
Or they mistakenly believe that they know when they don't.
Exactly. All right. Well, this has been, contrary to all evidence, the Book Spider podcast. Whose turn is it
Mine.
Next? Is Chris already gone?
Patrick.
It's yours? Okay, cool. Patrick, what's your book, Patrick?
We've all read a book by this author, but we've never discussed him yet. So let's read Galatea 2.2 by Richard Powers.
Okay. All right. Get some puns in.
Oh, man. Not more fucking Richard Powers.
Are you not a fan?
I have never been a fan of Richard Powers, no. I'll gladly read the book and discuss it for the podcast, but just be aware that I'm going into it with a pre-existing
dislike,
adversarialism toward Richard fucking Powers.
I didn't know that. I apologize. And
It's always fun.
No. This would be good.
He's fun to discuss.
I've tried with this guy. I've tried many times.
I've read two of his novels, The Echo Maker, which we've all read, and more recently I read Bewilderment, which is a newer one, and I really enjoyed both of them. So it'll be fun to see why you hate him so much.
I may not hate this work. I read The Echo Maker. I read parts of Goldbug Variations, and I read Three Farmers on the Way to a Dance. The latter two are much older work, so it might be that his style has evolved in ways that I'll find more appealing.